formal bodyguards for any excursions outside the palace, but he says they definitely will be reinforced. So, to our two letters. First, to our friend in the palace. Inform him that we cannot risk exposing our presence and our capabilities unless we're as certain as humanly possible of success. If we make an attempt of this nature, and we fail, it's unlikely enough of us will survive to make another attempt. And even if that weren't the case, an unsuccessful attempt will certainly cause them to increase their bodyguards and all of their other security precautions. Because of that, I will not authorize the operation, even if Charlian does carry out her plans to visit St. Agatha's, unless we have accurate information on the strength of her bodyguard at least several days before she departs the palace. I don't wish him to run any extraordinary risks in acquiring that information. Stress to him that he'll be more valuable where he is in the future, even if this operation is never attempted, then he would be unmasked and executed. Not to mention the fact that if he is unmasked and executed, it will mean this particular operation will be a failure anyway. Nonetheless, he needs to be aware that we simply can't act without that knowledge. Yes, sir, Shumei said, pen flying as he jotted down the bishop's points. Now for our friend in the mountains. Halcombe frowned, then inhaled deeply. I'm very much afraid we're going to have to risk widening our contacts, he said. We're simply going to need more men than we already have, and that means actively recruiting the people who can provide them. Tell him I'm assuming, on the basis of present information, that we'll have to increase the size of our force by at least another third, and possibly as much as half. I realize we've discussed the possibility that something like this might arise, and that he's done some preliminary planning already, but tell him to be extremely cautious about who he admits to his plans and how deeply he allows them to become involved and informed before the actual strike itself.
With all due respect, sir, Shumei said, but would it be wise to involve anyone who isn't aware, at least in a general sense, of what will be asked of them?
A valid point, Halcombe conceded. You're concerned that if they aren't aware of what we intend to do before the actual operation, some of them may balk when they do find out.
That's my major tactical concern, sir, Shumei agreed. There's also the moral issue, of course.
There is indeed.
Halcombe smiled affectionately at his aide.
And you're quite right that we can't forget our priestly calling and responsibilities, simply because we find ourselves called to a sort of service we never contemplated when we first took our vows. Still, I'm afraid our greater responsibility to defend Mother Church against her enemies outweighs many of our purely pastoral concerns. At this moment, and especially for this particular operation, we must think first and foremost in pragmatic terms about the tactics and precautions necessary to success. Every individual we recruit increases the number of people who may inadvertently betray us, our plans, and God, even if that individual is completely and totally trustworthy. Should someone not be trustworthy, not be fully committed to what we ask of him in God's name, then the danger of betrayal increases many times over. And should we recruit someone who might, as you're quite right to be concerned over, balk at the last minute, then that person would be much more likely to inform one of Wave Thunder's agents if he learned early on exactly what our objectives are. Finally, should someone feel inclined to balk at the very last moment, after our force has already assembled to launch the strike, it will, to put it bluntly, be too late. The mere fact that he's already joined us under arms in what the Emperor and Empress, despite their excommunication and the interdict, will quite properly construe as an act of treason against them, will mean he stands condemned before the Emperor's bench of a capital crime, whatever happens. Not only that, but if he attempts to withdraw, or even to actively resist our plans, we'll have the additional men available to prevent him from doing so.
He paused, regarding his aide's troubled expression across the table, and smiled sadly.
In some ways, I suppose, I'm guilty of allowing expediency to overrule conscience. And I'm definitely taking precautions which will make it effectively impossible for everyone involved in God's work to have made a fully informed decision about taking up that task. But I'm a bishop of Mother Church, Alvin, just as both of us are priests. We have a responsibility not simply to the individuals who may be involved in this particular effort against the schismatics, but also to all of the other souls which may be lost forever to Shan Wei if our effort is unsuccessful. However much we may regret it, we must make our decisions on the basis of that larger responsibility.
The bishop's expression darkened, and he shook his head.
I know I'm asking much of the loyal sons of Mother Church, Alvin, and it grieves me to do so without being completely honest with them beforehand. Yet, in my defense, I've asked as much or more of you, and of myself. We both have vows of obedience and loyalty to God and Mother Church, of course, and more is asked of any priest than of the souls in his care. But I never expected, when I took those vows, that those responsibilities would require me to set my hand to something like this. I know Charlian has made herself God's enemy. I know who she truly serves. And I genuinely believe that what we intend to do is the most effective blow we could possibly strike against the unholy alliance gathering to assail Mother Church. All of that's true. Yet, when I face God and the archangels in my evening prayers every night, I find myself begging for their forgiveness.
Do you, sir? Shumei asked softly.
Halcombe quirked one eyebrow, and the younger cleric shrugged.
I find myself in the same situation, he explained.
Of course you do, Halcombe said sadly. You're a priest. Priests are charged to care for their flocks, not to plan acts of violence and rebellion against secular authority. It's how we think, as well as who we are. And that's why we both find ourselves asking forgiveness for doing the very thing we know Langhorne now calls us to. I sometimes think that the darkest thing of all about Shan Wei is her ability to contrive situations in which good and godly men find themselves forced to choose between evils in the service of God. Is it more evil for us, as individuals, to act as we are? Or would it be more evil for us to refuse to act and allow this monstrous challenge to God's plan for all mankind to go unchecked?
The plainly furnished little room was silent for several seconds, and then Halcombe shook himself.
I know how you've already answered that question, Alvin. If you continue to have doubts, continue to question some of the actions to which we are called, that's completely human of you. Indeed, I think it would worry me more if you had no doubts. Even when the shedding of blood is necessary, it should never be easy, never be a trivial decision, arrived at without questioning, without being as positive as one can be that it is necessary. That should be true of any man, and particularly of any priest. But I believe you know as well as I do that in this case it is necessary, and that we must do whatever we may to ensure that we succeed in doing God's work.
He gazed into Shumei's eyes, and the younger man nodded.
You're right, sir, of course.
He tapped the sheet of notes in front of him.
If you'll give me a few moments, I'll draft the letters for your approval before we encrypt them.
May, Year of God, 893. 1. Talbor Pass, Dark Hill Mountains, League of Coruscant.
Sir Corin Garvey kept low as he made his cautious way to the forward redoubt. Coming this far forward in daylight was risky, although that wasn't a consideration which would have occupied his mind as little as 2 months before. Now, however, he and the men of his army had learned the hard way that to expose oneself anywhere within 1,000 yards of a Carizian marksman was likely to prove fatal. Even now, he could hear the occasional distant, distinctively whip-like crack of their damnable long-range rifles, and he wondered if whoever was firing actually had a target.
Probably, but not necessarily.
He grimaced. They managed to put the fear of their riflemen into us at Harrell's Crossing, just reminding us by firing an occasional shot, even at random, is one way to make sure we don't forget. Not that anyone who'd survived Harrell's Crossing was ever likely to forget. Of course, he reflected sourly, there weren't that many who had survived and were still with his army. Most of those who'd actually faced the Carizian Marines' rifle fire and survived were prisoners. Despite that, his men's loyalty remained unshaken. And so, more than a little to his own surprise, did their confidence in their leadership. In him. I owe a lot of that to Charles, he thought bleakly. We may have fucked up, but without Charles and his gunners, we wouldn't have gotten anyone out. The men know that, just as they know he, and I, never even considered running for it ourselves until we'd gotten out every single man we could. Garvey only wished Doyle hadn't left it quite so late. A handful of artillerists who'd managed to escape death or capture had told him how Charles had moved continually from gunpit to gunpit, exposing himself recklessly to the deadly Carizian rifle fire as he rallied his men. He'd been everywhere, encouraging, threatening, pointing guns himself, even wielding the rammer with his own hands on one of the last guns still in action, while 2/3 of its crew lay dead or wounded around it. Without his example, the men in that battery would have broken and run far earlier, and the trust Garvey's troops were still willing to extend to their commanders would probably be a much flimsier thing. Garvey knew that, but he missed Doyle more with every passing day. He'd counted upon the older man's sharp mind and imagination even more than he'd realized before he lost them, and he was painfully aware of their absence now. Besides, Charles was a friend. "At least you know he's still alive, Corin," he told himself. "And he's likely to stay that way, according to Caleb's letter. That's something. In fact, it's quite a lot. And you've still got Alec, too. That's nothing to sneeze at either, given what almost happened to him." Windshare had recognized the unfolding disaster and attempted to do something about it by getting his cavalry into the Carizian's rear, in the gap they'd obligingly left between their own formations and the woodland through which they'd advanced. Unfortunately, the Carizians had detailed an entire battalion of their infernal riflemen expressly to prevent him from doing just that. They'd hidden it in an arm of second-growth trees which had extended out into the farmland surrounding Harrell's Crossing, with enough trees and undergrowth to make their position effectively cavalry-proof. And their deadly rifle fire had more than decimated Windshare's lead squadrons when they attempted to ride past them to the infantry's assistance. Fortunately, horses were bigger targets than men, and Windshare's human casualties hadn't been as severe as the Earl had first feared. They'd been bad enough, though, and the loss of so many horses had been decisive. Windshare himself had had his horse shot out from under him, and he dislocated his shoulder when his mount went down. But one of his staff officers had gotten him remounted and safely out of the cauldron, and, to Garvey's intense relief, and not a little surprise, the Earl had called off his advance, rather than taking even worse casualties trying to bull his way through.
"I really ought to stop feeling surprised when Alec does something right," he scolded himself. "He isn't stupid, whatever else, and he's probably the best cavalry brigade commander in Coruscant. It's just..."
The sudden wheat of one of the Carizian's infernal bullets, passing unpleasantly close to his head, reminded him forcibly that he was almost to the front line and that it was unwise to allow his mind to wander. And, he thought with wry bitterness, quickly ducking back down behind the sheltering parapet, "it's also the reason I ordered all of my officers to take the damned cockades off their hats." He scrambled the last 50 or 60 yards along the communications trench to the redoubt he'd come to visit. The major commanding it saluted sharply as Garvey entered the work, and Sir Corin returned the courtesy with equal sharpness. He suspected that some of his subordinates thought it was silly of him to insist on maintaining proper military etiquette at a time like this, but Garvey was convinced the familiar requirements helped keep the men focused, not to mention maintaining their sense of identity as soldiers, rather than a frightened rabble huddling in their fortifications. "And I'm not going to let them turn into a rabble either," he promised himself and them grimly. "Good afternoon, Major," he said now.
"Good morning, sir."
"How have things been today?"
"More of the same, sir,"
the Major shrugged.
"I think some of their light infantry was sneaking around out there early this morning before dawn. We haven't seen any sign of them since sunrise, though."
"And their marksmen?"
"A pain in the arse, sir," the Major said frankly.
Then he grinned crookedly.
"As usual," he added.
"How bad are your losses?"
"Actually, sir, I think they were a little off their game today. I've got 2 wounded, only one of them seriously. That's about it."
"Good."
Garvey slapped the younger man on the shoulder, wondering if it sounded as bizarre to the Major as it did to his own ears to call 2 wounded in return for no enemy casualties good.
"On the other hand, that's exactly what it is, so there's no point pretending otherwise. Besides, I wouldn't be fooling anyone if I did."
Garvey climbed up onto the redoubt's firing step and very cautiously lifted his head above the parapet. No Carizian bullets screamed around his ears immediately, but he made a mental note not to assume things would stay that way as he rapidly scanned the approaches to his present position. Talbor Pass was the shortest, most direct route through the Dark Hill Mountains, although at just under 27 miles, short was a purely relative term. It was also a thoroughly unpleasant place to fight a battle. Shortest and most direct didn't say a thing about straightest, and no general in his right mind would launch an offensive battle in a place like this, which was precisely why Sir Corin Garvey's army was here. The western half or so of the pass was fairly broad and really did have extensive stretches of good going, but as one moved farther east it became increasingly narrow, twisting, and steep-sided, among other things. The handful of places that weren't bare rock or a thin coating of dirt over bare rock, which might support a threadbare patch of alpine grasses, were covered in tangled thickets of wire vine and dagger thorn. Whatever the wire vine didn't manage to entangle, the dagger thorn's 6-inch knife-edged thorns ought to cut to ribbons quite handily. Best of all, from Garvey's perspective, places where firing lines were more than 150 yards long were virtually impossible to find. In many places, the longest field of fire available was less than 50 yards, which suited his smoothbores as well as it did the Carizian's rifles. And it also meant the shorter-ranged Coruscantian batteries could count on holding their own against the Carizian guns. He couldn't keep the Carizians from sending their marksmen scurrying up the steep slopes to find suitable positions, but it had quickly become evident that the number of Carizians capable of those truly astounding long-range shots was limited. They managed to inflict a steady, painful stream of casualties, a handful here and a handful there, but there weren't enough of them to be a serious threat to his ability to hold his ground, especially not with the redoubts and connecting earthworks he'd ordered built. Most of them had been thrown up before what was left of his retreating advance guard had reached the pass, and they'd been steadily improved by working parties each night thereafter. By now, Garvai was completely confident of his ability to hold any frontal assault, assuming someone as smart as Caleb would suffer a sufficiently severe case of temporary insanity to launch any such assault. Part of Garvai was deeply tempted to pull back behind Talbor. He could have left perhaps a quarter of his total infantry strength to hold the fortifications, and it probably would have eased his supply problems. He'd fallen back to the west of the worst bottleneck before he'd ever dug in, so getting supplies forward to his advanced positions in sufficient quantity wasn't quite impossible. The bulk of his army lay spread out along the wider portions of the pass behind him, close enough to move forward quickly if the opportunity to do so presented itself, far enough to the rear to make supplying it relatively easy. That didn't make those problems magically go away, by any stretch of imagination, however, and moving 40 or 50,000 men out of the pass would have helped a lot. "I ought to do just that," he told himself for perhaps the 1,000th time. "But if I do, then I lose the ability to threaten Caleb's rear if he suddenly decides to go somewhere else. Besides, there's that little surprise we're working on for him." He grimaced as he gazed eastward, then ducked, as a puff of smoke blossomed high on the side of the pass, and a bullet thudded into the parapet close enough to throw dirt into his face. "See what I mean about being off their game, sir?" Garvai turned his head and saw the major crouched beside him, grinning. "Most days that bugger would have nailed you." Despite himself, Garvai found himself smiling back. He supposed some generals might have reprimanded the youngster for his familiarity, but Garvai treasured it. The major's what-the-hell-we're-all-in-this-together grin was the clearest indication possible that despite its awareness of how its enemy's weapons outclassed its own, his army was still far from defeated. "Well, Major, I suppose I've seen what I came to see, anyway. No point giving him an opportunity to improve his score, is there?" "I'd really prefer for you to get shot on someone else's watch, sir, if you insist on being shot, that is." "I'll try to bear that in mind," Garvai chuckled, and patted the young man on the shoulder. Then he looked back the way he'd come, squared his shoulders, and drew a deep breath. "Well, back to headquarters," he said, and set off on the cautious trek towards the rear. There hadn't really been any need for him to make the trip forward this morning in the first place. He'd already known exactly what he was going to see. It wasn't as if his personal reconnaissance was going to change anything, and it could certainly be argued that exposing the army's commanding officer to an incapacitating wound or death without some damned compelling reason wasn't a particularly bright move. But he'd made it a point to spend at least part of every day in one of the forward positions, primarily because he felt he did have a compelling reason. He was no more fond of the sound of bullets whizzing past him than anyone else, and his personal opinion was that an officer who deliberately exposed himself to fire when there was no need for him to do so wasn't proving his bravery, just his stupidity. Unfortunately, there were times when a commanding officer had no choice. Nothing could destroy morale faster than a sense that an army's officers were keeping themselves safely out of harm's way while leaving their subordinates exposed to the enemy. That was the very reason he'd found the major's reaction to his own near miss so welcome.
And I suppose, if I'm going to be honest, I did have a need to see the front lines with my own two eyes, just to be sure the damn thing was where I left it last night.
He snorted at the thought, then glanced up at the sky. One of the storm season's tropical storms was moving in on Coruscant from the east, across the great western ocean. To Garvey's experienced eye, it was obvious that plenty of rain and high winds were about to sweep in across Derwin and the Earldom of Corus yet again. It would be the second storm since he'd dug in here, which meant he had a pretty fair idea of what was going to happen when it hit. It was going to be thoroughly unpleasant here in the pass when the water began flooding his earthworks and trenches, but it wasn't going to be any picnic for the Corisians either. And it should, at least, keep the damned marksmen off the slopes for a day or two.
And the longer Caleb will let us sit here, the better. It may be hard work keeping the men fed, but it's the best damned defensive position this side of Manchir. And Caleb is about to get a surprise of his own, if Father's last semaphore message is accurate.
The Corisians' rifles had come as a nasty, one might as well be honest and say terrifying, surprise to Garvey and his army. They'd come as an equally unpleasant surprise, if at second hand, to Earl Anvil Rock. No one had been able to imagine how the Corisians had managed to equip every single one of their marines with a rifle which actually fired faster than most smoothbore muskets. Not until one of Garvey's surgeons recovered a half-dozen bullets from the bodies of his wounded men. The bullets had been badly deformed from their mangling passage through human flesh and bone, but they'd been sufficiently intact for Garvey to realize what he was looking at. It was another of those damnably simple innovations Corisian seemed so fond of. He'd been sure there were aspects of it which had required experimentation on the Corisians' part, but the underlying principle was absurdly easy to grasp. Instead of hammering an oversized bullet down the bore, which was the way everyone else forced it to take the rifling, the Corisians had simply designed a hollow-based, conical bullet. When the powder detonated, the force of the explosion spread the base of the bullet, forcing it into the rifling and sealing the bore behind it. And the bullet's stretched shape meant it was heavier than a spherical ball of the same diameter. It was probably also a better shape for driving through the air, although Garvey wasn't certain about that. And the fact that before the base expanded on its way to its target, it was actually a looser fit in the barrel than a regular musket's round ball, made it faster to load one of the new rifles than it was to load even one of his own men's smoothbore muskets. The critical point was that once the surgeon had realized what he was looking at, and drawn it to Garvey's attention, Earl Anvil Rock and his artisans had assigned the highest possible priority to figuring out exactly how the Corisians had made the design work, and how to duplicate it. According to his father's last message, they seemed to have done just that. There was no way they would have had time to manufacture anything like the numbers of rifled muskets the Corisians had, but his father was scraping up every single sporting rifle he could find and turning out new bullet molds for them. Garvey would be surprised if there were more than a couple of hundred rifles in the entire Duchy of Manchir. They were expensive toys, which only wealthy hunters could afford, and the fact that they came in such a wide diversity of calibers meant each of them would require its own specifically designed bullet mold. But even 50 of them, in the hands of trained marksmen of his own, would be a nasty surprise for the Corisians who were steadily pecking away at his men. "And if Caleb will just give me another month, say, just to the end of the storm season, for example,
Then Father will be able to start putting worthwhile numbers of rifled muskets into production. We still won't have anything like the same total numbers, but we'll have enough to convince Caleb to approach us more cautiously than he did at Harrell's Crossing. And if it should happen that the next time we fight an open field battle I've got a few hundred or a couple of thousand rifled muskets of my own, and he doesn't know it...
Sir Corin Garvey knew he was indulging in wishful thinking. Still, it could work out that way, and for now at least, he had a cork firmly in the bottle of Talbor Pass, and he had no intention of pulling it back out again.
"Still say we ought to go ahead and hammer him, Your Majesty."
It was hard to imagine a respectful growl of disgust, but Howell Churman managed to pull it off. Caleb's senior marine stood on the far side of the map table, glowering down at the broken-backed snake of Talbor Pass, and from his expression, he would have liked to personally throttle Sir Corin Garvey with his own large, sinewy hands.
"That's only because you're constitutionally opposed to doing nothing, Howell," the Emperor said mildly.
The general looked up at him and had the grace to blush, and Caleb chuckled. That chuckle was not a sound of unalloyed amusement.
"Trust me," he said, "I'm not incredibly in love with the idea of sitting on our hands either. But in your saner moments, you know as well as I do that hammering straight into the positions Garvey's managed to build for his troops is going to produce nothing but a bloodbath, rifles or no rifles. And not, unfortunately, a Coruscantian bloodbath."
Churman looked very much as if he would have liked to disagree, but he couldn't, and so he nodded unhappily instead.
"You're right, of course, Your Majesty. I just hate the thought of sitting here. We've got virtually the entire Marine Corps camped out here, and we haven't done a thing since Harrell's Crossing. We're giving them time, Your Majesty, and we're wasting time of our own."
"Granted." Caleb didn't even glance at the tall, sapphire-eyed guardsman standing behind him. "The problem is that we don't have enough mobility on land to slip around Garvey. If we had more troops than he does, we could try stretching out our right flank, forcing him to garrison other passes until he thinned out Talbor enough for us to punch through it. Unfortunately, he has more men than we do. And he also has a lot more and a lot better cavalry than we do. Carizians are seamen, not horsemen. You might want to get Admiral Lock Island's view on the proper degree of familiarity between sailors' asses and saddles. Believe me, he doesn't think they should spend any more time in contact with one another than they can possibly avoid. And that, unfortunately, in this instance, pretty well sums up the Navy's attitude in general."
"All of that's true, Your Majesty, but..."
"We knew it was going to be like this," Caleb pointed out. "Oh, I don't believe any of us thought it would be quite this bad, but we recognized from the beginning that we were going to face a problem rather like this one. So, while I fully understand why you're feeling so impatient, I think we'll stick to our original strategy." If he'd been speaking to anyone else, Churman would have puffed his mustache at Caleb. Since he happened to be speaking not simply to his superior officer, but to his emperor and commander-in-chief, he didn't. And in all fairness to the Marine, Caleb knew Churman understood exactly what he was saying. After all, the general had helped build their original strategy in the first place.
"You're right, of course, Your Majesty," Churman said after a moment. "It just goes against the grain to sit here doing nothing."
"As it happens, General, nothing is exactly what we aren't doing," Caleb said with a nasty smile. Churman's eyes narrowed, and the Emperor chuckled again. This time it was a much more pleased sound.
"The longer he's prepared to sit there, the better I like it, Howell," Caleb told him. "I'm still pushing the thought around in my brain, but believe me, if we can convince him to give me another month or so to work with,
He'll really, really wish he hadn't.
I'll take your word for that, Your Majesty,
Sherman said with simple sincerity, then bowed and withdrew from the room. The door closed behind him, and Caleb turned to Merlin.
That, he remarked, is an impatient man.
Not so much impatient as tenacious, I think, Merlin replied. He reminds me of a lot of Marines Nimmu knew. Their instinct was always to attack, to push the pace and keep the other side off balance whenever possible. When the Gababa pushed us completely back onto the defensive, they hated it, and not just because it meant we were losing.
I can see that, Caleb nodded. For that matter, I tend to be that way myself. The notion of giving the other side time to get set has never really appealed to me, or at least not usually.
He and Merlin smiled nastily at one another, then looked back down at the map of Coruscant on the table before them. The real problem, Caleb reflected, was that no one involved in crafting the overall Carisian strategy had considered making their landing in Derwin until very late in the planning process. The possibility that Grand Duke Zebediah might be able to convince his brother-in-law to come over to the Carisian side hadn't occurred to any of them until they learned of Prince Narman's correspondence with the Grand Duke. Their earlier plans had called for landing in either the Barony of Brandark or the Earldom of Chorus, if they'd landed east of the Dark Hills, or else much farther to the west, in the Earldom of Rocaire, if they'd landed on the Margot Sound coast. In either case, the idea had been that they would establish a firm foothold, then use their amphibious capability to offset the Coruscantians' greater mobility on land by leapfrogging along the coast in a series of amphibious hooks. Unfortunately, the combination of the speed with which Deros had fallen and the promptness with which Garvai had marched out to meet them had taken Caleb's planners by surprise. When they hadn't been planning on landing in Derwin to begin with, they'd expected it to take much longer for the main bodies of the opposing armies to make contact with one another. And because that had been true, they hadn't dared to count upon fighting a decisive battle quite that quickly. And, to be fair, judged purely by the casualties inflicted as a percentage of Garvai's total strength, it would have been hard to call Harrell's Crossing decisive. Judged by those casualties as a percentage of the strength he'd actually had on the field, and especially as a demonstration of the relative capabilities of the two armies, that was precisely what it had been, however. And Garvai had been far quicker to draw the appropriate conclusions than Caleb could have wished he'd been. The Coruscantian field commander's decision to withdraw as quickly as possible into Talbor Pass had precluded the possibility of another larger-scale Harrell's Crossing. He knew what Carisian rifles and artillery could do now, and even though Merlin's remotes confirmed that his father was working on providing him with an improvised force of riflemen of his own, he wasn't about to offer battle on Caleb's terms unless he absolutely had to. And so, Caleb had found himself in undisputed possession of the entire Barony of Derwin, the southern portion of the Earldom of Chorus, and a goodly chunk of the eastern part of the Earldom of Merak, far earlier than anyone had expected him to. And with the Coruscantian army far closer to intact than anyone had wanted it to be. The fact that the storm season promised to be just as active as Merlin had warned Caleb it would be, on the basis of his meteorological satellites, whatever they were, didn't help things a bit either. Thunder grumbled quietly from the east, as if to remind Caleb of that very fact, and he grimaced. The storm season was bad enough in Carus, but Carus very seldom saw the powerful hurricanes which could sweep across Coruscant, The sheltering bulk of Silverlode Island, which did get its share of hurricane-like storms, did much to explain that. Although, according to Merlin, the pattern of ocean currents had at least as much to do with it. At any rate, the storms which came roaring in off the Great Western Ocean to hit Coruscant were even more violent than the ones Carizians were accustomed to dealing with closer to home. As he listened to that distant rumble of thunder, Caleb was glad, for several reasons, that he'd sent so much of his shipping back to shelter in Zebediah and Chisholm. One reason, of course, was that it reduced congestion in Deros, and got his vital transports as safely out of the way of foul weather, and far enough north to be outside the normal hurricane zone entirely, in Chisholm's case, as he could. And if Zebediah was still right in the middle of the threat zone, the presence of a substantial number of Carizian transports and their galley and galleon escorts in Hannah Bay was a pointed reminder to Grand Duke Zebediah that any adventures which might tempt him would be a bad idea. Useful though that was, however, the ships sheltering in Chisholm were almost certainly even more valuable. The continued presence of so many Carizian ships and Carizian sailors, who just happened to have Carizian marks burning holes in their purses, continued helping to buttress the Chisholmians' view of themselves as part of the new, larger Carizian Empire. Even more of the Chisholmians who'd nursed reservations about the entire idea were finding themselves feeling much more comfortable with it, as the deep and genuine respect with which the Carizians had already come to regard Empress Charlian sank fully home. And as they listened to the Carizians' tales of the fortunes to be reaped by anyone who could go a privateering. All of that was true, but however useful those other accomplishments might be, what Caleb truly wished was that he had that shipping right here, closer to hand instead. Without it, he simply didn't have the troop lift for the amphibious tactics, which had been the linchpin of their strategy from the beginning. He was sorely tempted to try using the shipping he'd retained in Deros to carry out the same sorts of operations, despite the season, if only on a reduced scale. Garvai's decision to settle down in Talbor Pass with his entire army, however, had dissuaded him. The Coruscantian commander's position offered him a prize that was far too tempting to pass up. But claiming that prize would require a much larger landing than he currently had the troop lift to support, while a series of smaller landings was likely to provoke Garvai into changing his present dispositions at the very least. "Is he really going to go on sitting there?" Caleb asked now, and Merlin shrugged. "That's what it looks like," he said, and Caleb's eyes narrowed slightly. There was something about Merlin's voice. "Merlin," the Emperor asked slowly, "are you tired?" Merlin's eyebrows rose, and Caleb shrugged. "I'm sorry, but it's just occurred to me that I don't believe I've ever actually seen you tired. Once you and Michael told me the truth, I realized why that was, of course, but now, I don't know, there's just something..."
"I'm not really tired, Caleb," Merlin grimaced slightly. "Pikas aren't subject to physical fatigue. On the other hand, until I came along, no one had ever operated a Pika in autonomous mode for more than 10 days at a time. So no one had any actual experience on the long-term effects on the personality living inside one. From my own experience, I don't really need sleep the way a flesh-and-blood human would, but it turns out I do need downtime. A few hours, at least, every few days when I can just shut down. It's my equivalent of going to sleep, I suppose. And I really need it if I'm going to stay mentally fresh and alert."
"And you aren't getting it, are you?" Caleb asked shrewdly.
"There's too much that needs doing," Merlin replied obliquely.
I've got snarks and remote sensors out all over the place, Caleb, and Owl and I are the only ones who can monitor them.
Can you possibly monitor all of them, whatever you do?
No, that's part of the problem. I spend too much of my time trying to figure out which ones I absolutely need to monitor, which reduces the time I have to do the monitoring in. And it's virtually certain that I'm not monitoring at least one of the ones I ought to be watching. Then there's...
Stop, Caleb said, and Merlin's mouth closed. That's better. Now, listen to me for a moment, Merlin Athrawis. Your ability to tell me what's going on all over the world is an enormous advantage. Frankly, it's even more important than the new artillery. In fact, I think it's the single most important factor in giving us a chance to survive. I know that. Michael and Dr. Marklin and Father Jean all know it. But as you yourself have pointed out, you aren't really an archangel. You can't be everywhere and do everything. You can't even watch everything that happens across an entire world. Maybe you don't need sleep the same way I do, but I can't believe you're so different from the rest of us that you don't need to rest at least occasionally. Frankly, I think you're just as likely to miss something because you aren't... How did you put it? Because you aren't mentally fresh and alert, as you are because it didn't occur to you that something needed to be watched in the first place. People, including you, Captain Athrawis, make sure I get my sleep because I'm an emperor, and because I need to be rested and clear-headed when the time comes to make decisions. Well, you need to be rested and clear-headed for the same reasons. And also, in your case, because of how much I rely on you when it comes time for me to make decisions. If resting is what you need to do to stay that way, then I want you to do just that. Besides, you're my friend. I don't want you driving yourself too hard simply because you can.
Merlin looked at him for several seconds, then sighed.
I don't know if I can do that, Caleb, he admitted.
Try, Caleb advised him. Try hard, because if you don't, I'm going to order you back to Deros.
Merlin stiffened, and Caleb shook his head.
I'm not going to argue about it with you, Merlin. Either you're going to get, what, 2 hours a night of the downtime you were just talking about, or else I'm going to send you back to Deros so you can get the downtime during the day instead of watching my back. It's not open to discussion.
For a moment, brown eyes locked with blue, and then Merlin sighed again.
It was bad enough when you were just a crown prince, he complained. Now this emperor stuff has obviously gone to your head.
Was that a yes I heard?
All right, Caleb.
Merlin shook his head, his expression wry.
I'll be good.
2. Vicar Zomson's Suite and Vicar Jaspar's Suite. The Temple, City of Zion.
Response to the address is still coming in, especially from the more distant bishoprics, Zomson Trenaire said over his wine glass. Frankly, I'm not entirely satisfied with what I'm hearing, though.
No?
Jaspar Clinton smothered a fresh roll in butter and took a huge bite.
Why not?
He asked a bit indistinctly as he chewed.
I'm not convinced all of them fully understand the seriousness of the situation, even after what happened in Farade, Trenaire replied. Of course, they only have the expurgated version of the address, without the specific references to holy war. And it's probably taking time for the reports of the hangings to circulate, given this winter's weather. I suppose that could explain the fact that they don't seem to me to show the proper degree of urgency in all cases.
Clinton's face tightened ever so briefly at mention of the Farade executions.
Although he'd endured his own public penance with every outward appearance of humility and acceptance, there was no point pretending that the humiliation of admitting his own fault hadn't filled him with white-hot fury, or that he didn't still blame Trenaire as the person responsible for that humiliation. The fact that his intellect was capable of understanding exactly why the Chancellor had insisted upon it, and even the fact that he'd been perfectly correct to do so, didn't do much about his sullen resentment. There was a new, undeniable strain in their relationship as a result, but by the same token, both of them were even more aware than ever of just how much they needed one another. And, for all his anger, Clinton knew it had never been personal, or not very personal, at any rate. When it came to the survival of Mother Church and the Group of Four, business was business, as far as the Grand Inquisitor was concerned. Even if it did still piss him off. Now he washed down the mouthful of roll with a hefty swallow of wine and shrugged.
"If they don't understand now, they will soon enough," he said a bit more clearly, and reached for his fork once more.
Despite how little he and Trenaire might like one another, particularly these days, both of them knew they were the two true poles of power within the Group of Four. As such, they'd taken to dining privately together at least twice a five-day, in addition to the larger suppers when Robert Duquerne and Elaine Magware were invariably present, ever since the Carizians had decided to create so much havoc. As was customary when serious church business was to be discussed, the two vicars had dismissed their servants, and the Grand Inquisitor refilled his own glass before he looked back across the table at Trenaire.
"I've already made my displeasure clear to that idiot Jenkins down in Delphirac," he scowled. "If he'd kept proper control of the situation, we never would have had all that unpleasantness in Farade."
Trenaire managed to nod without grimacing, despite the way what had happened in Farade remained a sore point between them. What bothered him even more about it, though, if he was going to be honest with himself, was that Clinton seemed in a fair way towards convincing himself that his own version of events there was the accurate one, despite the official findings of the Farade Tribunal and his own public confession and penance. It was bad enough trying to manage the repercussions of that entire disaster without having the Grand Inquisitor actively deluding himself about it.
"I wonder if he's always actually been able to do that," Trenaire thought. "Is it possible that what I've always put down to cynicism and pragmatism has actually been complete, if delusional, sincerity? An ability to make his version of reality the truth, whenever the actual truth would be inconvenient? Or is this something that's only come out in him, or gotten stronger at least, since the Carizians didn't oblige him by all dying on schedule after all?"
The Chancellor had no idea how to answer his own questions. But at least he knew now there were currents inside Clinton which even he hadn't recognized before. Potentially dangerous currents, and not simply dangerous to the Group of Four's opponents. Yet even if that was true, or perhaps especially if it was true, it simply became more important than ever to keep Clinton both focused and under control.
"As if I didn't have enough to worry about already. I don't really know which is worse, Jaspar's dragon-in-a-glassworks approach to anything remotely Carizian, Robert's refound piety, or Elaine's stupidity. I really am starting to feel like Master Trenaire."
His raised wine glass hid his smile as his lips quirked involuntarily. He was well aware of the whispered temple cloakroom puns linking his own surname
with that of the traditional stage manager of puppet theater. No one was going to repeat any such jokes where he could hear them, of course, but they'd never really upset him particularly. After all, that was how he'd seen himself in many ways.
"But the play used to be so much easier to direct," he reminded himself, and his smile faded. "I'm not as convinced as you appear to be that Bishop Ernest could have prevented what happened originally, Jasper," he said mildly, as he lowered his glass after a moment. "And frankly, I don't see how he could possibly be held responsible for the outcome of the Carisians' attack on the port."
"No? Well, I damned well can," Clinton growled. "If he'd insisted from the outset that the Inquisition have complete control of the ship seizures, without letting those ham-fisted so-called soldiers screw things up first, then none of the damned Carisians would have gotten out. Probably as many of them wouldn't have been killed either, but even if they had been, Caleb and his bunch of deviants wouldn't have gotten the wildly exaggerated reports of what happened that put such a wild hair up their arses about Faraid."
Despite his resolve not to renew his quarrel with Clinton, and despite all of the excellent reasons he had for that resolve, Trinair's lips tightened. It was one thing to avoid conflict within the ranks of the group of four. It was another to let one of the two most powerful of its members engage in such dangerous self-delusion. Especially when the Carisians' version of what had happened in Faraid was getting such broad circulation. The letters and printed broadsides they left behind when they withdrew from Faraid had included the proclamation from Emperor Caleb and Empress Charlian, which had made their reasons for attacking the city and burning the better part of it to the ground crystal clear. And, as that bastard Rockpoint had promised, the contents of Gravier's files had also been broadcast. It was hard to be certain exactly where they'd first been distributed, but printed copies of every single self-condemnatory word of the executed Inquisitor's reports had mysteriously appeared from somewhere. And despite Clinton's best efforts, at least some of them were being circulated throughout the mainland realms, especially in Sidarmark and Delphirock itself. The Carisians' grasp of the value of propaganda, Trinair was discovering, was at least as good as the Church's, and it seemed impossible to stop their printed broadsides and pamphlets from getting out.
"All of which only makes it an even better thing I insisted that we had to address the situation ourselves, however Jasper feels about it," the Chancellor thought grimly. "I suppose he's right when he argues that the Tribunal's findings help to buttress the Carisians' claims about what happened, but it looks like an awful lot of people find our own openness and honesty deeply reassuring, and it gives them an out. They can accept that at least some of the Carisians' claims are true, but they can go ahead and reject the points where their accusations don't coincide with our own admissions. Like the question of just how much of the city was burned, and just how many civilians were killed."
As far as Trinair knew, no Delphiracan civilians had been killed in the Carisian attack, but there was no way for Karras to prove that. No handy captured reports which were bound to get out anyway, and leave all sorts of embarrassing mud on the Church's face. None of which meant that the Carisians hadn't demonstrated a fiendish ability to distribute their propaganda, like their version of Faraid, whenever and wherever they chose. Clinton seemed particularly irate about that. No doubt because he'd believed the Inquisition's ability to intercept such inflammatory documents was adequate to the Church's needs. What he was discovering, unfortunately, was that much of the Inquisition's previous success had been due to the fact that no realm or kingdom had ever before
dared to openly proclaim its opposition to the church. These were no smudgy, poor-quality sheets run off on a hidden press in some malcontent lunatic's cellar. These were every bit as professionally produced as anything the Inquisition or Office of Instruction had ever distributed, and literally thousands of them were mysterious.